Welcome to Going Mental. This is your host, Eileen Kelly. I'm interested in the things many of us face but don't always talk about. After spending 5 months at McLean Hospital working on my mental health, I'm back. A little more insightful and with plenty of stories to share. Expanding on my usual topics of sexuality and intimacy, this season takes into account everything I learned during my stay. I'll be bringing together a wide range of guests, some beloved, some contentious, to discuss work, love, and the bizarre phenomenon that is modern life. Join me as we try to make sense of it all. Today, we're going to be joined by Deja Fox. She is a thought leader at the intersection of social justice and social media. She is the founder of Gen Z Girl Gang, a student at Columbia University, and a digital creator with Ford Models, who got her start advocating for reproductive justice after experiencing homelessness in her teen years. At just 19 years old, she worked for Kamala Harris as an influencer and surrogate strategist and became one of the youngest presidential campaign staffers in modern history. Can you introduce yourself in your own words?
Sure. My name is Deja Fox. I'm 21 years old. I use she and her pronouns. I'm calling in from San Diego, California. I'm an activist. I'm a strategist. And I'm a future president of the United States. I'm currently a full-time student at Columbia University, and I'm the founder of Gen Z Girl Gang.
Sick. Okay, thank you so much. I'm so excited to have you on and reconnect with you. I feel like a good place to start is kind of if you want to tell me a little bit about your upbringing and what it was like to grow up in Tucson.
Sure, yeah. I was born and raised in Tucson, Arizona. It's about an hour north of the border, kind of a small town, but not too small. I grew up with a single mom, and like many households across this country, right, we struggled to cover the basics. She was someone who didn't go to college and jumped between jobs and jobs. I grew up in the financial crisis of 2008, right? Things were tough. And by the time I was 15, because of issues of substance abuse and financial instability, I ended up moving out and I experienced what 1 in 30 youth in the U.S. experience, and that's hidden homelessness. So for me, that looked like living with my boyfriend at the time and his family. And they were a very welcoming and loving family who treated me like their own. And then I went on to college, moved to New York.
How did your experience with, you know, poverty at the time kind of affect your mental health? And how did it shape your passion for political activism?
Yeah, I mean, I think poverty, right, is such a, it's a tangible thing. It's the kind of thing where you can point to, right? It's not having enough food in the fridge. It's not knowing where you're going to spend the night. It's not knowing if you can afford to go on that field trip, right? And there's so many layers to the way that financial instability in my youth affects my mental health today. My outlook on money, my own anxieties, but also my reality, right? I live in a very different reality than my peers at Columbia, for example, who have parents who can, you know, float their rent or buy them that plane ticket or get them that internship. And so in that sense, I'll say that it's not sort of the experience of growing up poor doesn't stop when you have money in your bank account. There's still so many ways that it impacts my outlook. Like I said, especially my anxieties, as I come into my adulthood.
Yeah. And I'm sure your identity. And you mentioned that you grew up with a mother who struggled with substance abuse. Yeah. And do you feel like that kind of forced you to look elsewhere for kind of sexual health information, or that influenced your kind of activism within that realm?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think a lot about, whether it's sexual health, right, or mental health, the ways that me and my mom were both failed by a system that doesn't consider what access looks like, right? How do we make these things not just legally available, but accessible to the people who need them most? And I remember a moment, you know, when I was like 15, asking my mom to help me get birth control, and her just being very honest with me that she didn't have the capacity to do it. She didn't know how, and she didn't know how to help me. And I think about that often, that we have to, as a community, as a country, step up to create that access. I think we often, when we talk about mental health, right, we're always talking about like self-care. But I have lived in situations, I've been in situations where I wasn't able to care for myself, mm-hmm. or my mom wasn't able to care for herself. And so I believe deeply in community care when it comes to any kind of health. But yeah, it definitely impacted my own ability to access sex education and birth control. And, you know, as I looked at my school, which was not providing me with adequate or accurate sex education, I got active. I started showing up to school board meetings with my friends, telling our stories and asking them to make a change, really demanding that they as elected officials create a change. And after 6 months, we won that battle. It's continually being fought. But it really showed me the power in my voice and in my story to create access, not only for myself, but for the people around me.
Yeah. And I think for young people who are listening to this episode, how do you have any advice for them on how to get involved with their communities? You know, from such a young age, you were making real tangible change. And so anyone who's listening, like, do you have any advice?
Yeah, I think the best advice I can give is to get personal. I feel like when you look at social media, it seems like everybody's the founder of a nonprofit or it has this like giant network or something like that. But in truth, that's not where most of us start out. I started out as a volunteer with Planned Parenthood, tabling at events, right? Canvassing, door knocking. And that gave me the foundation I needed to continue to build my work. And so get personal. Think about what issues are personally affecting you. You know, when you see things in the news, how is that playing out in your real life? What does your experience bring to the table? And how can you use that narrative as an agent of change making? And think about your personal network. You don't have to have a million people behind you. You can bring your significant other, your friends, your parents along, because if they care about you, they're going to care about what you care about. And that's really the core of relational organizing.
Yeah, and starting small and then letting it kind of become a domino effect.
Yeah, totally. And maybe it doesn't become a domino effect. Maybe you stay local, and that's so valid. We need people at every level. And I also think something, a note to young people, is that we do not all have the same place in this fight. And if we did, we wouldn't be very effective. So know that your activism doesn't have to look like somebody else's. It probably won't. And that's great.
Yeah, I think that's a really great note. Let's talk about your Jeff Flake video.
Yeah, when I was 16, I went to a town hall meeting, and I asked Senator Jeff Flake, he was a Republican senator at the time, who had just recently supported stripping Title X funding, the funding through which I personally received birth control, and that millions of people access birth control at no cost to them. He had just voted to strip that funding from institutions like Planned Parenthood. And so I went to this town hall and I asked him why he, as a white, privileged, middle-aged man, was making decisions about me and my body and my life. And he told me that he supported policies that support the American dream. And I asked him why he would deny me the American dream. And I think that's the sticking point. You know, someone recorded it and the next morning I woke up and it had millions and millions.
Like 17 million views, yeah. Or something wild. Did you expect that? Did you know it was getting recorded?
I knew it was being recorded because, like any good organizer, I recognize that media is an important part of the change-making ecosystem. I also had been trained in storytelling already, right? I knew how to use my story. I'd been prepping for this moment, but it was much bigger than I could have even imagined. And you never really know when it's gonna happen. But right, when you go, this is called bird dogging, this tactic of trying to get public officials to say something on the record that then can be used against them or used in the media. So the tactic is to get them to say something and say it on camera.
Got it.
But yes, I knew I was being recorded. No, I didn't know that it would blow up. And I don't think there's any way that as a 16-year-old you can prepare yourself to have 17 million people have eyes on you and your life.
I can't imagine.
And I remember the next day I had an inquiry that for CNN live, right? Like, that's a big pressure to know that you're going on CNN all by yourself live the next day. But I will say that this is when preparation meets luck, right? It was lucky that it went viral, but I'd been prepared. There were organizers in my corner who made sure I knew how to tell my story, that knew, that helped me learn how to speak to media, helped me feel confident and ready should this happen. So,
how did it feel kind of going from a typical high school student in Arizona to appearing on, you know, live news networks? I think you were called like the new face of Planned Parenthood, and so many like articles getting written about you.
Yeah. I will say I was never the typical high school student, right? I was working at a gas station at the time, and I did for a few years after. I was struggling. I was, you know, living in an untraditional setting. I wasn't living at home with a parent, right? And so I think that we have to understand that I was coming from a vastly different baseline already, and then being asked to do more than I was already doing, right? I was mm-hmm. being asked to not only go to school and ace my AP classes, and then go to work at a gas station and grind for minimum wage to make the ends meet, but I was also being asked to show up and lobby on Capitol Hill. And at the time, it felt like a real privilege. And in a sense, it is, right? These are doors that were never open to women like my mom. But it also was a huge responsibility. And I think a lot about it now. And it's why I fight so hard that youth activists be compensated for their work, compensated fairly, because we ask so, so much of young people, our implementers, our organizers. And frankly, I think they deserve a lot more credit, a lot more money, and a lot more say in messaging and strategy. Yeah,
I mean, that kind of segues to you were like one of the youngest campaigners in modern history, and you served on Kamala Harris's campaign trail. I'm wondering how that came to be.
Yeah, I think that transition, working at a gas station when I was 18 years old and then 19 years old working on a presidential campaign as one of the youngest staffers in modern history. I was a full-time strategist out of the headquarters on the digital team.
In a position that didn't even exist before you were there, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, digital in and of itself is a brand new field, but I worked as the influencer and surrogate strategist. So yeah, totally a brand new space. The influencer space is ever evolving. So yeah, that transition from working at a gas station at 18 to a presidential campaign at 19, I myself am still piecing together, right? How does someone create that kind of social mobility for themselves? And the one thing I can really point to, or rather two things that I can point to, are one, social media. The social media gave me the power to own my narrative and build a personal brand and build connections that otherwise wouldn't have been available to me, right? And two, sisterhood. That there are women, particularly women of color, who have shown up for me time and time again. Who bring my name into rooms that I'm not in, that tell me I'm qualified for jobs that I don't even consider for myself. Mm-hmm. And that really is the story of how I got that job, how I was able to step into that position. I got a DM on Instagram, actually. As I was moving into my sophomore year dorm, I was literally unpacking, hanging my clothes up, and I get this DM with a job description for the campaign. And I messaged her back, and I was like, I have some friends that just graduated. Let me go ahead and send you some recommendations tonight. And she said, you know, I think you'd be a great fit. Why don't you consider it? But you'd have to withdraw from school.
Who sent you this?
Mina Harris. Mina, you know, sort of gave me this, I think you should apply. I think you'd be great. And it was something that I hadn't considered for myself. And again, this is that idea that because of social media, I was able to build a connection with someone that I otherwise wouldn't have been able to. Mm-hmm. And as a woman of color, right, she invested in me. She saw my potential before I was ready to see it and pushed me to see it too. And I think in that sense, when I look at the social mobility I've created for myself in my own life, it really is those two factors, that it is social media that has allowed me to be myself loudly and create those connections that otherwise wouldn't be available, and sisterhood, that there are women that continually show up for me.
Do you feel like, you know, you talk about going from the from a minimum wage job in Arizona yeah. to all of a sudden you're at an Ivy League school with, you know, surrounded by influential and extremely privileged people. Yeah. And has that shift affected like your personal identity at all?
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
Like, do you feel like you oscillate between the two, or you don't know where you stand, or I don't know?
I think what's interesting, right, there is this idea of oscillation, maybe like code switching, switching between one and the other. But I'll actually say that because I've stepped into a space like the Ivy League that is so foreign, that is so different to me, I've actually become more myself. It has pushed me to be less like that. I feel that more so in high school, I almost had to pretend to be this kind of thing. Then once I got to the Ivy League and realized, you know, so many people talk about this experience of stepping into a college. I'm the first in my family to go to college. I'm on a full ride, right? This sense of imposter syndrome. And I actually had a very unique and interesting experience, which was that I stepped into those classrooms and I realized how incredibly mediocre my classmates were. And I was like, oh my God, I deserve to be here. A lot of these kids don't. I do. I work to be here and I know that.
Can you say a little bit more about that? What do you mean by they didn't deserve to be here? Like they got in through family connections, et cetera.
Not just that. I think about the process to get into any college, right? What are they really measuring? And I think in high school, I'd always imagined that getting into a place like the Ivy League must mean that you were the smartest, the most talented, the most creative, but that is just not true. When we look at the determinants of how you get into a school like Columbia, SAT scores and grades and extracurriculars do not always align with the most talented, the most creative, the most special, the most smart, but rather the kids that have been given the opportunities to build themselves into those perfect applicants. And that's what I realized, that I saw kids from my neighborhood who were just as smart, if not smarter, who weren't going to college. And that these kids didn't intimidate me one bit. And that rather they were intimidated by me because I worked to get there.
And you worked against a lot of odds too.
Yeah, a lot of odds. My starting line was way further back. And I think that there's this sense for me when I'm on campus, of real pride that I know I worked to be here, that I deserve it. And the people that I see really struggling with imposter syndrome around me are the people who aren't so sure that they deserve it, aren't so sure that they worked to get there.
Wow. That's going to like leave me with a lot to think about. Can you tell me a little bit about Gen Z Girl Gang? So you started this your freshman year of college, correct?
Yeah. So it's sort of tied to that experience of showing up at Columbia and being able to see into this backstage of really, you know, privilege, and recognizing that as a community organizer, I had always viewed community as the people who lived around me, but that wasn't true at Columbia, that the people who shared my experience weren't the people that were next door, right, or down the hall, but rather people I was connecting with online. And so Gen Z Girl Gang was born out of this idea that there's real power in the personal networks that we cultivate and build in a digital space, and that Gen Z, particularly Gen Z women and femmes, are leading that kind of relational organizing. And like I said, in my own life, I saw how sisterhood and social media coupled to create social mobility for someone like me. And so in a sense, Gen Z Girl Gang is really about redefining sisterhood in this digital age and using social media as a community building tool and empowering young women and femmes to become the leaders that we need to take on these really scary issues that Gen Z is facing, whether it's climate change or the rise of hate and nationalism, right? We need young women and femmes at the forefront. And that's just a fact. And the way that they're going to get there is by supporting and collaborating with one another to lift each other up.
So through Gen Z Girl Gang, like women and femmes and young girls can meet each other. And then do you guys hold events, or what is kind of like the day-to-day on that?
Yeah, the day-to-day looks different. We really prioritize meeting the needs of our community, whatever they are. And they change all the time. And so for us, we used to host a lot of in real life events, and they were really fun. We hosted one that was all about college access, where we talked about how to tell your story and your personal narrative as a part of those essays, right? But we also had a panel about being the first in your family to go to college. We hosted events like Galentine's Day, where we just brought the girlies together to celebrate one another. And so there really was this aspect, and I'm hoping we'll get back to it as things start to open up, of in real life connection, building new friendships, meeting each other. But we also use social media to do that. You know, we have active group chats where folks talk about everything from like mental health to sharing opportunities. And then those opportunities get shared on our story every week. We've shared thousands of opportunities, whether they be internships or jobs or fellowships. And in that way, we're really all about community sourcing our content and really just serving as this like connector for the girls in our community.
I think that's, I've always thought this about you, how inspiring and how much you're doing. Like, I don't even know how many hours do you have in the day. You know, you're a full-time student. You are working on her campaign. You run Gen Z Girl Gang. So I just want to give you like applause to that.
Thank you.
You set the bar really high.
I will say though, you know, I've already mentioned this, that in high school, I was working a lot harder. I think about the kids that have to go to school all day and then go work for an hourly wage. Those kids are working really hard. How many hours a day do they have? Because I know, and it's not easy. And what I do now is vastly different. And in some ways, though there's more responsibility, I have more time to myself. And I also, you know, I wouldn't want to play into this idea that you can do it all, because I can't. I have people behind me. I have teammates. I have agents, right? I have people who are hustling on my behalf. Because if you see anyone doing 110%, there's no way they're doing it all on their own.
All on their own. No, that's very true. I'm the same way. Yeah. Obviously, so much of your career and what you talk about is social media kind of based and driven. I'm wondering if you've ever experienced the more sinister side to social media. And if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, social media and I have this really complicated relationship, in that my financial stability, also the connections that I'm able to make, right, whether they be personal or professional, are tied to social media. And these are things that a lot of people are born into, right? A lot of people have a financial safety net and connections that they can rely on via their family. I don't. I've built those things all through social media, and they're dependent upon my use of social media.
Yes.
And so when things get bad, I can't just delete my account. Right? I can't just disappear because I'm tied to it for the things that I need to literally survive and to even try to get ahead. And so I think often about this sort of abusive relationship between creators, especially creators of color, creators who come from low-income backgrounds, who really rely on these platforms, and the way that they demand. They demand that you keep producing. They demand that you keep sharing more and more and more about your life. To stay relevant. And I don't have an answer for that. I think it's something that me and a lot of my friends are struggling with at the moment, a question we're all grappling with as this creator economy really takes hold. But I think it's definitely, it's double-edged. It has both provided me the things I've needed to live a life that is more financially free, but it has also been the major source of my anxiety for the past 3-4 years.
Yeah. Have you ever been the center of like any cyberbullying, trolls, doxing, like anything like that? I know I personally have had a lot of experience with cyber harassment. And so I wonder if someone who also exists on social media in a similar way.
Yeah. I mean, it is varied. It's run the gambit, whether it was when I worked with Planned Parenthood, right? I got a lot of like that kind of hate, random trolls, people who like didn't exist in my real life, but there was like high volume. I've had more personalized incidents with people in my personal life sharing things on social media that made me either feel uncomfortable or vulnerable or were meant to be hurtful to me. And I've also had sort of somewhere in between where, you know, most recently, a white woman took one of my TikToks and put it on Twitter with just the caption, "Enemy just dropped," or something like this. And like directed people to, it was very odd all around. But within the matter of hours, it had like 60,000 likes and like thousands and tens of thousands of retweets. And I was receiving all kinds of hate. And
what was the TikTok about?
Oh, it was literally a TikTok of me introducing myself. I was like, "Hi, my name is Deja. I worked on a presidential campaign. I go to Columbia and I'm a digital creator at Ford Models. Like, I want to help young people see their power."
Does it feel personal? Like, are you able to separate it? Or does it feel like a personal attack when that stuff happens?
It's a mix, right? The initial tweet, completely impersonal. I don't know this person. There's nothing about me. But then I think the thing that's tough and why I think Twitter is the bad place is because it starts to snowball,
yeah.
Right? People who don't know you start talking. People who do know you start talking. And then it's just, I mean, it's uncontrollable. It is completely out of your hands at this point. And I think there's something very scary, again, about being so vulnerable online. And, you know, sharing so much of my life and knowing that at any point it can be taken completely out of context or out of my own communities and put into a place where there's a lot of malice for me. And that is scary. And again, this goes back to that sort of toxic relationship, an abusive relationship between creators and the platform, because there's really not an option to just step away from it when so much of your livelihood is tied.
Do you hope to get to a place where you can step away?
I also question, right, if the world is letting that happen, or if now we're all required to have a social media to be successful professionally anyway. I think, you know, more specifically for me in the immediate, why it's impossible to step away is the financial aspect. But I'll also say, like, sort of in a long-term scope, I think so much of our personal brands, our ability to build futures for ourselves, is tied to creating this like persona online and maintaining it. And so I think it's a bigger question for our generation to grapple with. Is that something we're going to allow ourselves space to do? Is it something we're going to allow our peers to do? But it's hard to know. I don't know.
Yeah. I ask myself the same questions. This is just a fun one I'm just coming up with off the top of my head. But like, how many hours per day do you think you spend on your phone? Like, I definitely spend way too many hours on my phone.
Let me get you the number. Let's look at our screen time.
Okay.
Oh, geez. I like almost don't want to know, but I spend about 8 hours. On my phone, which is a lot of time. That's a lot of fucking time.
It's a lot of time. I mean, I'm probably in the same boat. It's just fascinating, yeah. Especially someone I think who's in an older generation than us listening to this podcast. I think that could feel like unfathomable and unrelatable.
Yeah, probably.
But it's, you know, you're doing so many things. You're sending emails, you're making TikToks, and once again, like you said, this is literally your job. You're carving out a future for yourself.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's one of the things that's so tough about social media, working in the social media space. My friends will always tell me, you know, they're like, "Oh, but you're on your phone for good reason, right? Like that's where you work." And I'm like, yes and no, because when I'm on TikTok, when I'm on Instagram, for some people that's decompression, right? They're just on there, you know, this is sort of a personal thing. But for me, whenever I'm on there, it flips into work mode, right? And so even though I might be enjoying a regular amount or even a little bit more screen time than other people, I really am in work mode when I'm on my phone, when I'm on social media. And so it's very hard to step away. I think something that Gen Z also is going to be grappling with is this inability to separate work from personal, right? Like, we take our phones into our beds with us at night. And if you're working from your phone, you're bringing work into bed every night. And similarly, right, like anyone can get a hold of me anytime they feel they need me. And I think it's more difficult now than ever to create a separation.
Yeah, how do you, I mean, you talked a little bit about social media causing an anxiety spike for you.
Totally.
Yeah, how has it affected your psyche, mental health?
Yeah, I think there's like the day-to-day anxiety, whether it's just like in the back of my head that, oh, I need to do this thing, or what are people saying about me, getting in too deep on comment sections, right? Like there's sort of like that neurotic behavior. But there's also these larger moments that are like deeply traumatizing for me, like times I've gone viral, or times that there's been immense amounts of like hate or, you know, personal attacks, that those feel really real. And that the same experience I had the first time I went viral at 16, right, waking up, 17 million people have eyes on me in my life. That experience is replicated so many times over. I've gone viral three more times, or three times total. And every time people say to me, but isn't this what you want? Isn't this a good thing? But it's incredibly vulnerable. People are not built to have millions of eyes on them all at the same time.
Yeah, and millions of eyes who don't know them, who aren't fact checking, aren't, you know, like, exactly. And I think that's such an important point, kind of what you said about the snowball effect on Twitter. People are so quick to jump onto things without really forming their own opinion or kind of getting the background of the situation. And that's really scary.
It is really scary. I also think that in a lot of ways on social media, there is no way to present your entire self, right? Like, I go out of my way to be my most authentic self online, but there is no way that I can convey the entirety of me, my wholeness, in a platform like Instagram or TikTok or Twitter. And so in that sense, I think something that I've had to come to terms with is that people online will never know me, will never know me in my totality. And so in that regard, you know, you have to take criticism and compliments with a grain of salt.
Yeah. What are some tips or little things that you do to kind of protect your vulnerability, protect your mental health, your self-esteem?
Yeah. I mean, I turned off like all my notifications at this point. There is no need for me to be pinged about what people are saying about me. I think an eighth grade teacher told me that other people's opinion of you is none of your business. And I live by that. I try to put it into practice. I tell my friends, if you see something about me, don't tell me. I don't want to know. I don't care.
Okay.
Don't tell me. I pretend I do not see it. Unless it's going to be a real threat, I don't want to hear about it. Similarly, you know, I recognize that I shouldn't be taking criticism from people I wouldn't take advice from. There's a lot of people with a lot of opinions online, and that you can't make people who are not your people, that you are going to lose followers over time as you grow and change. Right. And that's okay. That there are people, who are going to come and go. And as you continue to evolve, you'll attract different kinds of people, different amounts of people. And that's totally fine. And so in that regard, I mean, I really just try to remember that I am separate. I am a whole person outside of what other people perceive of me online. And that I have a rich life in real life with friends that care deeply about me.
Yeah, I think that's really smart to kind of create that boundary.
Yeah, at least that boundary of self, right? Of self-perception.
Yeah, and protection, exactly.
Yeah.
I have a couple more questions about Kamala and the campaign trail. And I'm just wondering your specific reasons. Obviously, they reached out to you, which is really interesting. Yeah. But your specific reasons for supporting a candidate who was not one of the most progressive options for a Democratic nominee.
I mean, I would contest the piece about progressive. I think she had some incredibly progressive policies. And again, I think this is one of those places where people have to do their own research, where people have to dig in. But also, I understand that civics, that politics is inaccessible on purpose. And that often what we get in these bite-sized chunks on social media is not the full picture.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that as a woman of color, as a first-generation American, as one raised by a single mom, all of those things are true of Kamala Harris. And I believe in the power of perspective. I understand that representation is important, and not just on some surface level, but that when you have these lived experiences, you make different decisions. You see the world differently. You view policy and politics as personal in a way that others don't. And I'll never forget my orientation on the campaign. I was in the most diverse campaign in the field. I was routinely in meetings with just other women of color. And our boss sat us down and put one word on the presentation. It said perspective. And he said to us, you know, so many of you have never worked on campaigns before. There are people out there with more experience, but you all were chosen because you bring a unique perspective because of who you are. And that really stuck with me. And I think I'll never settle for a workplace that is less than that now. But this idea that lived experience, perspective is valuable and is a kind of knowledge that we should cherish.
Yeah, and representation. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll also say she has an amazing pro-choice track record, right? Mm-hmm. She was of the candidates, probably the one who aligned most with my own views of reproductive justice.
I'm wondering about your views and how it aligns with, you know, her work as a prosecutor. I'm sure you hear this all the time. I would just love to hear your views on this firsthand, you know, and being essentially a policewoman on some level.
No, it is not the same as being a policewoman.
Okay, I just want to hear what you would say to people who who have that view of Kamala Harris. And how does that align?
Yeah, this was a widespread view while on the campaign, right? Mm-hmm.
And also how you dealt with people asking that and saying it on the campaign trail and online.
Yeah. I think the thing to do in these situations is really to provide an alternate narrative, right? To allow people to see what they're not seeing. And we know for a fact that a lot of that, like, Kamala's a cop rhetoric was being promoted by bots, was being promoted by the right even, and being seeded to people online. And in fact, it was misinformation. It is misinformation, which is incredibly dangerous for our generation and something we have to think about as we think about protecting our democracy. But to sort of address the question more pointedly, Kamala Harris has been the first in some way in every position she has ever held. And something that a real visual representation, something that struck me was, I believe this is in her book, she talks about walking down a hall when she was DA or AG and pointing to all these portraits of the white men who have been in this position for hundreds of years and saying, you know, and they expect me to fix it all, right? I think we put so much pressure on Black women to fix it all. And as someone who decided to work from inside the system to make tangible, real impact, I think it is incredibly unfair to require her or any other woman who dares to be the first to clean up the mess made before them and to hold them responsible for the actions and the system built and perpetrated by white people. I think it's incredibly unfair. And I will also say that I think it's incredibly brave to take an unpopular position because you know it is the right thing to do, because you know that your voice needs to be in that room to advocate for people, to make a real difference. And I think I encourage people to do their own research into her Back on Track program. I think that was a model for a national program that was really important. And that's what I would sort of point to.
Yeah. Think that will clear up a lot of confusion or questions for people listening.
Yeah. I'll also note, though, one last thing.
Yeah.
Is that I'm not a spokesperson of that campaign anymore.
Of course.
Right? And this is my own personal understanding of it and how I made sense of it and how I came to make my own decisions about who to support, where to work. And I'm still incredibly proud of that decision. I think when you make a decision wholeheartedly, it's easy to stand by.
So post Kamala, can you tell me a little bit about Ignite the Vote and kind of the work you were doing with that?
Yeah. In the wake of COVID, right? Like as COVID first started, it was unsure how long it would last and just how strict we would all have to be. I saw a lot of nonprofits really struggling to transform their programming, right? Whether it was tabling, canvassing for Ignite, it had been, they had planned to do this cross-country bus tour to do an Ignite the Vote, get young people on campuses excited, which no longer was going to happen. And so I really saw, as someone who works in digital strategy, an opportunity to help these nonprofits transition their programming to meet this moment in a way that was effective and innovative and different. And so with Ignite, I helped them put together an influencer program to replace what they were going to do in person. And it was really wonderful. We engaged people who worked, you know, in the mental health space, creating videos on TikTok, to organizers on the ground for racial justice. We were able to include so many different perspectives and really turn this sort of, like, I think with Get Out the Vote efforts, people often want to get like the biggest A-list celebrity names, but really turn that theory on its head and say, how do we engage community builders and content creators whose audiences have a real stake in them to drive them to make a plan to vote and to get out and vote day of? And it was incredibly effective. We got millions and millions of views and tens of thousands of actions. And we were able to uplift the voices of some really amazing people.
So the results were positive. Do you feel like you'll be implementing, or you hope that kind of brands and stuff will implement that in their own publicity?
I think it's two-part. I'd like to see individuals and brands and organizations implement this strategy. And the strategy is digital relational organizing. It's the idea that the people that follow me have a stake in me, and that they care about what I have to say. And that is both a responsibility and an opportunity. And so whether you have one follower or 1 million followers, if you have an account on Instagram, right, you have a responsibility and an opportunity to engage those people who follow you and have a stake in you. And so I'll say, on a personal level, each of us has a responsibility as a content creator and community builder online. But also on the side of orgs and brands, I think I would encourage them to really work with the people who have those engaged communities and to think outside the box and to do their own research, or to hire someone who will, and, you know, to share those opportunities in a way that is that's more equitable and a little bit more inclusive and thoughtful.
What do you mean by, like, that response, their responsibility?
Yeah, again, this goes back to that piece about digital disinformation, that one of the biggest threats to our democracy right now, in my opinion, is misinformation spread online, is things that are untrue being spread at scale. Again, I saw this on the campaign. I saw the ways that anti-Black racism, that, you know, patriarchy are being upheld through the spread of misinformation. And so I think if we are all going to be anti-racist, if we are going to be feminist, we have to really be thinking critically about the information that we're spreading. Similarly, when we're in campaign mode and when we're not, we have to be thinking about, is what I'm sharing true? Have I vetted it? Is this something that I can truly stand on? And I think oftentimes people are prioritizing being quick to being thoughtful.
What are you currently working on? Any fun projects?
Yeah, I am in the middle of finals for school, so there's that. I'm trying to get through. I'm trying to get my grades and get out.
Good luck, finals.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough season for any student. So I'm working on that. Gen Z Girl Gang is having our second year anniversary, which is very exciting.
Oh, amazing. Congratulations.
And, you know, I think the biggest thing that I'm working on and that I think young people need to hear is I'm working on being happy. This pandemic, I came into it at 19 and I'll be leaving at 21. And it has taken some of, like, the most fun years of my life, mm-hmm. in some regard. And so I'm really working on having a good time, building memories with my friends, allowing myself the space to enjoy. And I think more young people need to hear that.